everybody. Patrick Connor here, and welcome to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. I mean, every episode's special, but this one's extra special. It's kind of brought about under unfortunate circumstances, I suppose, after the unfortunate death of Antonio Inoki, who was a Japanese pro wrestling star. So we're talking history, of course. We're talking boxing and pro wrestling history a little bit, but that means I'm here with my dude, Aris Pina, CompuBox operator, and we've also welcomed back Box Rec Gray. What's up, Gray Johnson? How are you doing, man?
It's a pleasure. That's right. I guess it's my second time now, so thanks for having me back, guys. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And Aris, dude, I know this is like your wheelhouse too, man. Like, you guys are more hooked into the wrestling history and stuff than I am. I'll try to keep up, but this is definitely your guys' game here.
Yeah, man. You know how I always drop like wrestling references on the show throughout, if it makes sense. But yeah, Inoki is one of those guys that kind of crossed over with everything. So that's why I was definitely good enough to mention for the podcast. Plus, he's a part of one of the most infamous or famous, whatever how you want to look at it, moments in combat sports history with what he did with Muhammad Ali. So yeah, there's lots to discuss. Quite an interesting legacy to go over.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously there was more to Antonio Inoki than just the Muhammad Ali fight, which is what we're going to be talking about today. You know, his legacy and his influence on combat sports, not just boxing, not just pro wrestling, but also mixed martial arts, without question. So, I mean, there's a lot of history there to unpack. We're definitely not going bullet point by bullet point. It's just to have fun. Just a couple of nerds, you know, going over this shit for the most part. But look, dude, you know, Antonio Inoki, obviously the first thing we think about, the first thing almost anybody, especially in boxing, thinks about is that Muhammad Ali fight in 1976. Like you said, Aris, it's famous and infamous, and there's a lot of like mythology surrounding it, a lot of rumor, stuff like that. I mean, but even going into that fight in 1976, it's like the twilight of Ali's career already. And, you know, coming into this fight, a lot of people, especially from the United States, did not know Antonio Inoki. Who was this guy?
True. So, yeah, by the mid-70s, like you said, Ali had just gotten over with the Thriller in Manila, and people were basically begging him to retire because he should have. Like, he was already showing signs of just being worn the fuck out. And instead of that, he decided to go in there with Ernie Shavers and a bunch of other host of just monsters.
He's doing a world tour.
Yes.
At that point, he's fighting in Puerto Rico. He's fighting in Germany. So not surprising that he's calling out a Japanese wrestler as well, because he's just taking paydays or in these countries that are paying him a lot of money to fly over there.
And then the guy like Inoki at that point, he came up at the same time. So he came up under a guy, to a little history context, under a legendary Japanese figure still revered to this day, named Ricky Dozen, exactly, who is basically the godfather of Japanese wrestling. And you know, he was the one all the American evil foreigners would go over there, guys like Luthes, whoever, and they would lose to him. You know what I mean? He'd be the one that knocked him down, and the guy was just like a god. And the two wrestlers that were his proteges that ended up becoming subsequently the biggest names in Japanese wrestling themselves was Antonio Inoki and Giant Baba. And by the time those two made their American excursions, Baba, who was bigger than Inoki, he was like the Andre the Giant type mold, a giant of himself. He was being featured like at MSG and like, you know, having matches with Bob Backlund and doing all this stuff and kind of being prominent. Inoki, on the other hand, as when he was making his American debut, he was being sent to like minor territories and farm systems and whatever, and just kind of being as an afterthought. So by the time the mid-70s rolls around, like Gray just said, Inoki's not really well known at this point. He's still kind of a mystery to American audiences. And you're wondering, you know, what is Ali getting himself into? Ali has always shown a tendency, obviously, from his antics outside the ring, and he actually talked about it. He loved pro wrestling. So, you know, it wasn't like the fact that he was getting involved in it so much, which was like not odd. It was the fact that he was getting involved in it with a guy that was a total non-entity and someone that was mysterious to American audiences, unless you were like a hardcore fan and kind of recognized them, you know, from the excursion there, you really read the magazines, you know what I mean? So it was, it kind of summed up the whole business of boxing in the mid-70s anyway. So there you go. Everything was just weird.
Yeah, supposedly Ali had gone. It's so supposedly, dang, of course I changed the page, but he had met up with someone prior to choosing Inoki, I guess, and he had made the remark that, don't you guys have any Orientals that I could beat or anything like that? Don't you have any Orientals that can challenge me? I mean, his words, not mine, obviously. But that remark had gotten out to like Japanese press, and they, you know, that had somehow gotten back to Antonio Inoki. Of course, I changed the page, so I don't see where it was. But regardless, anyway, yeah, that's supposedly how that started, or how Inoki got involved, was that Muhammad Ali had made some flippant remark to some Japanese sports person that he had met up with.
Yeah, and then, of course, one thing leads to another, and Ali gets like an offer to fight Antonio Inoki for like $6 million. Now, wrestling's in this weird kind of spot in the 70s, because, yeah, as many people know, it's several decades removed from being legitimate. Like, we're talking, I don't know when it started being more they scripted, or they went through it, but probably like the 20s and the 30s, you'd see guys shifting away from wrestling being like, you know, what you're seeing are two dudes rolling around like for an hour and a half, like legit, to it being more, you know, entertainment. But at the same time, it's still being presented as legitimate. I mean, I think Aris and I probably, you know, with the birth of the internet, was really the end of what they call kayfabe, which is the word they use. It's like, you know, trying to, you know, keep the secret, the work, you would say, away from the fan base, wrestling fans, and present it as a real thing, and don't, you know, pull the curtain. But I mean, it wouldn't be for another 20 years, really, that the curtain was completely exposed. So yeah, it's at this point where they're still trying to show wrestling as legitimate, especially in Japan. So it's kind of in this weird space of like, how is this fight going to work exactly? Because Inoki is used to doing these worked fights, and Ali's a legitimate fighter, but at the same time, Inoki has this training and knows how to certainly protect himself in a ring. So right from the start, it's, you know, a styles clash and a creative clash as well.
Yeah, there was. The thing with New Japan Pro Wrestling as opposed to All Japan is that All Japan, which was run by Giant Baba, both of them kind of split early on and became competitors. Giant Baba's organization was more so leaned toward like how American wrestling was too. Like, you can tell, yeah, it was interesting, but, you know, it was still scripted or whatever. Inoki, like you said, Gray, he was more into like the whole strong style, which it would become known as later on, where it was based on more like, yeah, Inoki wanted to present pro wrestling as its own combat sport, and wanted to present pro wrestlers as the elite fighters out of any sport, whether it be karate, boxing, any other, you know, entity that there's out there. He wanted pro wrestlers to be that type of guy. Decades later, that would come back to kick him in the ass and completely fuck up his organization, but that's a whole other.
True. Inokiism did end up sinking New Japan in the early 2000s, as Aris is pointing out, and then ended up Inoki being completely removed, and then New Japan going into a more entertainment type style, and All Japan now is the one that really still presents the sport as a little more serious. I mean, you know, as serious as wrestling can be in the you know, 2020s, let's be honest. But yeah, it's definitely like Inoki was all about protecting his image, presenting himself as a legitimate fighter, like similar to Hulk Hogan in the United States, rarely losing his worked matches. I mean, this is a guy that would always be the one with his hand raised at the end, essentially. Yeah, he was the biggest draw, made a lot of money for the company, made a lot of money for himself, and that's how he wanted himself presented, as a legitimate tough guy, which I'm sure he was. But
It was. You have to remember too, this was a year removed from a famous video of Inoki where I sent it to you, Pat, and it's been, since he passed, it's been put all over Twitter and other stuff. There was a guy by the name of the Great Antonio. So a year before, 1975, the guy named Great Antonio, who was a strong man from France, I think, or somewhere,
Not strong that night. He was very, he let himself
definitely
go.
Not, yeah, but just when you see him, he looked like a fat, homeless, overweight dude, which essentially,
but yeah, his whole shtick was that he'd like pull trucks and shit, yeah, like that. Yeah, yeah, and so, yeah, yeah.
And so, and in wrestling, when you get, yeah, when you get old in wrestling, that shtick still doesn't go away, which when it really should, like, he clearly couldn't, you know, he looked like a blob, but you know, yeah.
And he didn't, and for whatever reason, in his mind, he thought he could fuck with Inoki. And like during that match, like Inoki's trying to work with him, as awkward as it was. And the dude's the guy's completely making it a joke. He's laughing at him, he's pulling his gut out, doing the stuff. And then at the end, he starts getting really stupid by like clearly hitting a dude, like rabbit forearming Inoki as hard as he can. Doosh!
And these are not pulled strikes at all.
Yeah. They
are,
and that's when Inoki snaps, painful, takes him down, and then stomps a mud hole in him, literally just like, yeah. I mean.
Inoki palm strikes this fucker down to the canvas, yeah, and just stomps a hole in him, like legit kicks, legit strikes. Yeah.
Well, this is what Ali was essentially getting himself into the ring with.
Yes.
Post-Miller in Manila.
A guy that could defend himself, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and also like what you guys are talking about with a kind of like the strong style or hard style wrestling that Inoki used to show. I mean, for a lot of people, even I think for some wrestling fans, probably less so for wrestling fans, but combat sports fans who might not be aware, might or whatever, haven't seen Japanese pro wrestling, and they see it, and then like some of the punches look like pretty legit, and you're like, that's a hard strike. Holy shit. You know, whereas a lot of the time it's sold a lot more in American pro wrestling and in the major, you know, organizations and stuff like that, more often than not, like punches and things like that.
Yeah.
And so that can be kind of shocking, I think, for a lot of American fans. But yeah, you know, I think Muhammad Ali, I mean, I don't really know what was in anybody's heart going into this. You know, I think that Antonio Inoki, he probably wanted to just show up. Like he wanted to even be like, fuck, what's up? You know, like it was his big opportunity to whatever he wanted to do, get 15 minutes, show off Japanese pro wrestling as a superior art form or whatever the case may be. But Muhammad Ali, obviously, at some point, whatever the initial agreement was, it sounded like it was supposed to be a fix, as Bob Arum said, or a work. But Muhammad Ali didn't want it. And there was no way for them to have some meeting of the minds where like they could, you know, have an easy draw or something like that to where, you know, they could agree upon something. And you could tell in the first round where they're actually like, it's funny because I said this to Aris earlier in the very first round when Inoki starts trying to drop kick Ali, the first thing Ali does was start kicking him in the thighs. And I was like, oh shit, I didn't even remember him doing this. Like,
yeah,
he should have stuck with that. If he'd stuck with that, he might've been in business, dude.
So to rewind, Pat, the story goes when they were trying to initially propose an ending to this fight was because it's in Japan. Of course, Inoki's getting that motherfucking hand raised, use my language, but that hand's going up. So the idea was that Ali, you know, they do their fight, Ali would accidentally hit the referee and be distracted, and Inoki would then hit him with an enziguri, which would be this like kick to the back of the head, and knock Ali out cold, and then the referee would come to and award Inoki with the KO win, but keep, you know, Ali could save face because it was, you know, under dubious circumstances. So whoever it was, either Ali or maybe someone in his entourage, they were like, absolutely not is that going to happen. No way. So the legend goes that they nixed that. Ali comes to meet Inoki a couple days before the fight, and Ali probably, I can kind of believe it, that maybe someone in his camp was like, no, we're not, you know, Ali's not losing. And then Ali like went to Inoki and went, so you want to like figure something out here? And then Inoki apparently was like, no, this is a real fight now. Like we're doing this for real now. Like, you know, Inoki's like sparring with dudes on the canvas. And I was like, all right, like we're going into this like a legit fight, I guess. So yeah, they just couldn't come to an agreement, like you said. And then all of a sudden here they are fighting 15 rounds.
Oh dude, yeah. And whoever in so I mean, the book I was looking at too, just I would normally not plug this writer or this book, but it's His Life and Times, Muhammad Ali by Shmamish Schmauser, and fucking
I a man who's made a living writing off of that subject. Like, he's written 850 books.
In that indeed. One book.
Only good thing about it is that there are some pretty key interviews in it about that. So, I mean, like, that's beyond that, I don't really care. But it talks about this fight, and it talks, and it gives some, you know, some insight into some of the shit. And they don't even really say exactly why or whose idea it was to have it 15 rounds and 3 minute rounds. Cause they're like, what the fuck were you guys thinking? And I mean, you know, however it actually came about, dude, obviously I don't know. I mean, nobody wanted to really lose face, I guess, but yeah, fucking disaster.
It was.
There was also the rule too, right? Where they split
the rule set.
Yeah,
I was gonna say, like, the rule set Aris was like a negotiation within itself, because they saw Ali, you know, grappling, doing throws, choking guys, and Ali's camp was like, yeah, he's not allowed to do any of that. He can't grapple, he cannot throw, he can't do any of that wrestling shit. That's not going to happen. So basically the rules were, and they were like, and also this rule set will not be made public before the fight. So essentially all Inoki was allowed to do was kick, I guess he could punch Ali technically, but if he was to throw a kick, he had to do it while having one foot on the canvas. Hence this guy crab walks for 15 straight rounds, just throwing kicks awkwardly at Ali. Like, it's insane. Like, it's pretty, I mean, if you want to seek this fight out, it's bad. But yeah, it's Ali on the feet, Inoki on the ground, just trying to kick Ali's legs out underneath him. It's something to watch.
It's one of the rare ones where I can tell you, you'd rather read about it than actually watch it.
Absolutely.
Like, there's books and stuff about it. Read about it because the whole story is fascinating, like we're saying, as opposed to you actually watching it.
It's a long hour of your life, not worth it.
If you want to watch anything regarding Ali, wrestling wise, there is a pretty funny clip. I guess he was promoting himself for the Inoki match because it's around the same time, where he shows up in WWWF and he confronts Gorilla Monsoon, who I guess we'll bring up in a minute too, because he adds to the story in his own way. But he confronts Gorilla Monsoon after a match, starts talking his shit. And at this point too, Ali is like playing the heel because he's a boxer coming into wrestler's territory. And I want to say that this took place probably in Pennsylvania, where they used to hold the house shows all the time. And so Ali's there running his mouth, blah, 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 blah. And then funnily enough, he goes over, he starts throwing jabs on Monsoon, dancing around, and Monsoon, because he's a lot bigger, just picks Ali up like he's a little kid, puts him down and gives him an airplane spin while Ali's screaming and yelling and flailing himself. And Monsoon drops him. Ali plays like he's all dizzy and falls out. He plays it really well, gets all dizzy, starts yelling and curtain, you know, pointing away. And Monsoon gets to the mic. Yeah, yeah, a little pipsqueak. That's what you do when a wrestler gets a boxer. So seek that. Don't actually seek out the Inoki fight, because that won't suck.
I mean, the only thing that's really super notable about the Inoki fight is Ali does try and change tactics at one point, grabbing Inoki's legs in, like, I think round 10. And you kind of are like, oh, like, is he going to try and like grapple with this? Like kind of push, like fight him on the canvas, but it doesn't really happen. And really the only thing that's super notable is like, the fight's a draw because they were, I think the judges and the referee, again, I'm putting in quotes, who knows, but I'm sure they were terrified to actually pick a winner here. But Inoki lands over 100 legitimate leg kicks on Ali. And the legend goes is that Ali got a blood clot because of it or something like that. But I want to ask you guys your thoughts.
I've seen photos of Ali after the fight where his legs are wrapped up, like all that, and there's stuff on him. So I don't know if he has surgery, but yeah, that is the story.
So I want to ask
you. He said too that Ali, who wasn't moving as much in his second post-career, we have to admit that, but
I was going to say
noticeably slower even after that fight in terms of moving anything.
That was going to be my question to you guys, is that you've probably seen Ali's later fights more recently than I have, but he goes 4-3 for the rest of his career, never scored another knockout. And do you guys think that this work shoot bullshit that he does with Inoki with the leg injuries really affects the last four fights?
Not only did he not score another knockout, he didn't even score another knockdown.
Yeah,
crazy. And that's Bernie Shavers.
So I mean, like, that's saying quite a bit.
Can't even knock down Ernie Shavers.
Honestly, dude, like, The first couple rounds of the Inoki fight, I feel, are at least, you know, watchable enough because they're interesting. It starts getting really redundant, like super quick. But like I was saying earlier, like very early in the fight, when Inoki starts trying to fight him from his back a couple times, Ali starts like kicking the shit out of his thighs. And I'm thinking like, damn, I don't really remember him doing this. And watching him going like, if he had just stuck with this, like he might have forced Inoki to get up or something. I mean, I don't know. I mean, in any scenario, if Inoki like gets a hold of him for real, dude, it's gonna be a bad fucking night. But yeah, even immediately after the fight, they're zooming in on Ollie's thighs and they're fucking red and purple and all marked up and swollen. I mean, they look legit fucked up. And Ferdy Pacheco he said, according to him, and I mean,
not a great primary source.
I honestly, it's very, and on top of that, dude, it's from this book, which is very hagiographical, dude. It's very like complimentary to Ali. So of course it's like, I almost feel as though they're being exaggerated to make him look better. Like, oh my God, he's this fucking warrior who lived through this. He may have, but according to Pacheco, Ali had this like series of engagements all across Asia planned. Like he was supposed to go to fucking like Malaysia, and then he was supposed to go to somewhere else to like dedicate a mall in like Philippines or something like that. And so Pacheco and other people, according to Pacheco, were like, champ, don't go, champ, you know, you can't go, you got blood clots, you're gonna die, you're whatever it is. And then he's, according to him, Ali's entourage had a bunch of people who were giving him poor advice that like Pacheco said, yeah, with that kind of injury, you got to elevate your legs in ice. But these guys had him doing, they were rubbing him down and giving him massages on blood clots. Who does that? You know, this type of shit instead. So, I mean, I have no fucking clue. Obviously he was injured though, because you could see him immediately after that. You know, he fights the Ken Norton, you know, the final Ken Norton fights and shit. And it's not the same kind of fighter. He's not up on his toes. There's a lot more trying to sell shit, a lot more bullshit, a lot more like, you know, yelling and talking and screaming and like swatting type of shit at him, you know, like he's like barely even fighting half the time. So yeah, I think that it probably did damage his legs like significantly.
For sure, man. Those were bad. Like Inoki, that's all he could do. And if you get kicked, like Inoki's a strong guy, right, man? And he knows how to kick. Even in the weird crab thing he was doing, you get nailed in the thigh in the things for 15 rounds, 3 minute rounds, over and over and over. And all you're doing is just running away, and like, you know,
Ollie's quit. Like up in the corner. He's like, "Fuck this!" Yeah. Climbing up on the ropes.
That's that is the most iconic moment. Shot is Ali jumping up on the turnbuckles, like mouth open, like what? Like, and looking at Inoki.
Inoki's sure laying back there with his foot up, just trying to get, you know, nail him again.
It's an awesome visual, but it's definitely like the best part of a
For 45 minutes, it's rough. It's fucking
It sucks too, because like I would love to find either a shirt from that event. Like I want to own a ticket from it, because the tickets are absolutely beautiful and like cool memorabilia, but just
great poster too.
Yeah.
All those Inoki, we'll talk more, but a lot of the Inoki versus boxer posters are really, really cool.
Angelo Dundee, I know, was really against the whole fight too. Wasn't he like vehemently saying this was stupid, and I don't know why he was the, you know.
Absolutely hated it, yes. Was he even over there? I don't even know. Like,
I don't know.
I don't even know who's Ali's corner was. I wasn't really paying attention, but it's a, not a shining moment in his career. But I want to say
he was there, but not positive.
Yeah, what's kind of notable about that day is that there is another boxer versus wrestler match that takes place that exact same day in a different part of the world. So this was a simulcast. So they would go. So the main event, of course, is Ali Inoki in Japan. But before that, during the day, the Worldwide Wrestling Federation had its Showdown at Shea event, which was their annual, big card they do. And, you know, they draw like, this is again testament to how more important boxing and wrestling, pro wrestling, was back in the day. That you could draw a crowd of 32,000. That's pretty. That's all in a day's work, right? Nowadays, like most promoters would be drooling at that.
Oh yeah, if you got 30,000 anywhere, they'd be talking about that shit for fucking 18 months.
So here it is, Andre the Giant. I'll let Aris take this away here, but it's Andre the Giant taking on Ali opponent, Chuck Wepner, here to cash in his 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah. So, like Ray just said, man, Ali Inoki was taking place, and so the dual simulcast, what the dual cast was going to be at Shea Stadium in the big field, which they would hold. That was almost like their WrestleMania events. Like they had Madison Square Garden where they big, you know, they would do their monthly shows, and that was always packed. Allentown, Pennsylvania, in that little shanty box is where they would hold the TV tapings, but.
Yep.
Shea Stadium is where you would hold the super show. You would get like, you know, Sam Martino or Pedro Morales or whoever was champion, Bob Backlund and superstar Billy Graham. You know, I'm giving you everybody from the 70s. They would, you know, the big blow off to a feud would go out there and the whole stadium would be packed. But this is big stuff, man. Now you're getting boxing and wrestling. Like I said, the WWWF was working with Inoki to a degree in New Japan at this point. So they had a working relationship. So probably they had a deal where they were able to show this and then make a dual card with it and promote it as such. Andre the Giant, obviously, and especially in the 70s, was the biggest attraction to wrestling, if not one of the biggest attractions in all of sports. You know, he was just one of those guys that the way he was promoted was actually really genius, because they didn't Vince McMahon Sr. was the one who was like his main booker, but they didn't allow him to stay in one place for a certain amount of time. Yep. So like if you brought him into a town, he wasn't going to be there for like 6 months. So he got stale and you would see him every week. He'd be there only for a spot two or three times. You get to see a person. This is pre-internet. So all you've done is read about him in magazines and seen this freak. Hey, now he's coming to my hometown. He's going to fight my local bad guy. He shows up, beats everybody up, wins a battle royal, moves on. You don't see him again for a year. So he's like, you know, a special attraction. You get that. Then you get a guy like Chuck Wepner, who is just, you know, his guy speaks for himself, right? You know, a New Jersey lovable lug who somehow is still around in the late 70s, considering his career was going on in the 60s, and he was getting his ass kicked by the likes of Sonny Liston back then. So somehow in 1976, he's still relevant. He had fought Ali at this point, right?
He had fought Ali, was also lost to Dwayne Bobick.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys, if you haven't done a show on him yet, I hope you do in the future. But yeah, he's definitely on the tail end of the career, the twilight. And yeah, he goes in there against Andre the Giant, and I think wisely, no, this was a worked fight. This wasn't real or anything.
But here's the interesting thing, though, is that from what I've read, I don't know if this is true or not, but I read on YouTube the other day that someone says that Gorilla Monsoon's nephew, as proclaimed to be, says that it went from what was supposed to be a work to ended up being somewhat of a shoot at the end.
That's honestly what it looks like.
And that's what it does fall apart. Yeah, it does fall apart.
And they said that what happened was is that, you said that beforehand, Andre and Wepner got together. They kind of talked it over, said they're going to make it fun. Wepner lands a coule of punches. Andre chases him.
Yeah.
Yada, yada, yada. They get together, finish it up. At some point during the match, Wepner started getting a little cute and started throwing some legit punches at Andre. Andre was so much bigger than him. I mean, Wepner was never known to be like a giant puncher to begin with, so Andre probably had no effect, except it was irritating him. And then at one point, as they're grappling, and Wepner's getting annoyed himself because he feels like he felt that Andre was being a little too rough with him and that he didn't like it, Wepner tried to, you know, go legit. So he starts with the rabbit punching, the same thing we mentioned Great Antonio doing to Antonio Inoki. You see Wepner legitimately hard, like cupping down. And then that's when they said, that's when Monsoon's nephew claims that everything went to hell. And he says that Andre looks at Gorilla Monsoon, who was in the, who was ringside, and I'm going to bring him up in a second. He yells at him and goes, shoot! And that, you know, and that Andre voice.
Shoot, brother, we're shooting.
And he goes, shoot! And that's when he grabs Wepner like in a bear hug and starts like mauling him around, like throwing him. Wepner, you see, flailing away clearly because he's like, what the fuck is happening? Yeah. And no one has ever done this to a guy this size. And Andre hits him, I think, once legitimately with like a body shot. And then like a fake headbutt, but enough, even a fake headbutt by Andre is going to knock the shit out of you.
It's going to still fucking hurt, of course.
Yeah. So Wepner leans back. He's like, oh. Andre picks him up like a sack of garbage. And at this point, Webner, who we mentioned, is a big boy. You know what I mean? He's like, he's flailing still. And Andre just dumps him over the top rope.
Yeah, I was going to say, not a safety dump either.
Like,
he dumps him like
a sack of shit. Yeah, like,
And Webner just drops. He's all, and he looks like a wet bag of garbage. He's all sweaty. He's wet. He just drops, boom, boom, and falls out.
And now, to Andre's credit, this is probably the planned finish. So, like a true pro, goes to the count out. But, you know, Andre wins, of course, and Webner doesn't, you know, gets his little count out. So it's not a total end of the world. So they got to the end of they got to the end, but it probably was not the road taken that was planned.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the best parts of that, at the very end of it, you see Al Braverman, who is Webner's manager and one of Don King's main lackeys, and a couple of other
guys.
They come running in. Flail it like years later, like Floyd Mayweather, like remember it's when Leonard Ellerbe and company were yelling at Big, you can't do this.
Yes.
But this time I think it was actually real. Braverman then comes screaming and cursing up, you can't do this, what the fuck? Gorilla Monsoon comes in like gangbusters and starts shoving fucking Braverman and weapons
crowing. Yeah, there's like a ringside melee.
And you see
Gorilla Monsoon, by the way, is like a 350-pound man. Oh
yeah.
Like this is like, these are also not small. Like these are fucking giant drunk wrestlers.
Webner looks like a combination of shell shocked and like fucking confused, and also maybe a little bit mad because he just got thrown outside the ring. Like because he's like, what the fuck?
Because he does try to get back in there and confront Andre again, and Andre's like, I'm done with this. I'm gonna go get drunk or something. But like, you know, it was a fiasco. It was an absolute fiasco that fit perfectly with what they were going to watch in the big screen. But I will say the stadium definitely got their money's worth. That was hilarious.
And very smartly was not the main event of that show because they ended with the Bruno Sammartino match. So I always thought that was a very smart move that they went with the classic wrestling match to end the show to help you forget that you've just watched Andre the Giant, Chuck Webner plot around for 8 minutes and do whatever the fuck they just
did. And then Ali and Inoki for another fucking 45.
I
would love to know how Shea Stadium reacted watching Ali and Inoki, because New York fans in general are already kind of irritable and like, you know, short-tempered to begin with. And to watch that waltz, like, I'm, you know, Ali was popular, but I'm sure not that many people were familiar with Inoki.
Imagine bringing your girlfriend to that.
Oh, God, yeah.
Jesus.
Baby, that was going to be amazing. Watch, man. The first, like, oh, my God.
We're just watching the birth of MMA.
God, they kind of were, but it's like.
It kind of was.
30 years from now, they'll call this mixed martial arts.
Martial arts, that's right.
It's absolutely fascinating, man. Just what a wild time. Ali's late career and the things that he was getting into and all that. But
yeah,
here's the thing. Once that happened, and even though that was an absolute clusterfuck fiasco, that made Inoki. So especially on the US, that did like things.
Totally.
You know, everything kind of once that level went up, he was up to here now. And then
his ego went up even higher because he said, I need to start doing these pre-fixed. I need to make sure the fights are pre-fixed next time. And I'm going to fight any legitimate guy I can pay to get in the ring with me. And lo and behold, guess who's the first boxer to take him up a year later after Ali, but Chuck Webner getting another payday. So
I didn't even realize that Webner went to Japan.
Webner went to Japan in October 25th, 1977. They do another boxer versus wrestler match. So what's kind of sucks is that the parent company of New Japan, by the way, are just absolute assholes about copyright strikes. So it is a pain in the ass to try and find these fights on YouTube. I couldn't actually. I think you can get like a New Japan World subscription, but that, you know, good luck. I think the site's in English now, but I remember like I got like a trial and it was all in Japanese. I had to like, you know, use a translator to figure it out, so that you might be able to find it on there. But dude, they are such jerks about copyright strikes. So unfortunately,
it's tough to find a lot of good footage from New Japan.
It's So I wasn't able to track down any footage, but there are photos of Inoki putting Chuck Webner in a Boston Crab, which is awesome. So he's got the legs and he's pulling back on him.
Of course he would.
Yeah, So the official result is Inoki defeats Chuck Wepner in round six. So I believe that they, like, if this was like other Inoki boxer fights, he wears gloves in the first few rounds and then just decides, fuck it, takes them off.
I was reading about wrestling. This. I was reading about this earlier, and that, yeah, like, they both wore gloves, and supposedly it was like he like got like TKO'd in the sixth.
Okay, yeah. So, unfortunately, like I said, I'd love to see footage of this, but yeah, well, this was a completely news to me type of fight when I was doing research for this show, that Chuck went back to the pay window to get another payday. So good for Chuck.
Respect it.
And then another one, so a year later, this one shocked me. Like, I had no idea this one also took place, but Inoki, I guess, has a Rolodex of former Ali opponents.
Oh, no.
So he's just flipping through going, who else can I do these annual? He promoted them as different style fights. That was the official, I guess the phrase that he used. But I guess technically, did Mildenberger never actually fought Ali, did he? I'm trying to think. Did he actually fight Ali?
Yeah, Carl Mildenberger fought Ali, yeah.
Oh, he did.
Yeah. I think so. Ali's yeah, first, but now Ali's you got me. First,
in Ali's first title, title reign before he was exiled.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I was 66 like,
I didn't want to make sure I was wrong. Okay. Cool. So he fights Carl Mildenberger, who's like a German boxer. So same idea. Like a year later, he's like, we're doing this annual boxer wrestler thing, and this fight is sort of similar. Mildenberger kind of, they both have gloves on. Mildenberger's kind of beating him up, but they kind of stole from the original Inoki Ali ending, where Mildenberger starts getting mad at the referee for breaking them up and starts talking shit to the ref, and then Inoki just takes him down and puts him in a fucking arm bar and taps him out. It's just hilarious, you know. And the confetti and he's got the big bouquet of flowers, and you're just like, yeah, man, this is so funny, just him just getting these guys to lay down for him. So yeah.
And this is also, you know, again, the Ali fight was 1966, and it wasn't that much longer than that Mildenberger fought Oscar Bonavena. And like, even at this point, like, you know, years and years earlier, it was like, you know, just no disrespect to Mildenberger, but he just was considered like, you know, a non-factor in this entire equation, basically. And so, yeah, for whatever reason, Inoki was just going through and going, who can we get?
Of all people, that is such an odd pick.
It is. It really is. Like, I was like, I got a little mixed up there for a minute because I'm like, wait a minute, Mildenberger wasn't one of his later opponents. So I was like, shit, he did fight him, right? Like, I just couldn't remember. But
yeah, he had me doing like a Mandela effect feeling there for a moment.
Like, yeah, right.
Even then, too, he's not like a popular Ali opponent. Like, you know, I'd be like, oh, yeah, there was that Carl Mildenberger fight. No one really talks about it.
And he wasn't fighting in the 70s. Like, what a weird, like,
exactly. Time. Yeah, it's like, just like this, years later.
Yeah, you know, like, Inoki must have just, like, I don't know, he must have, like, knew somebody. He was like, yeah, can you get me, like, a boxer? Like, and they're like, oh, this guy's got, like, legitimate credentials. But yeah, Inoki was all about fighting guys with, like, you know, a lot of kickboxers, too. A lot of guys, like, you know, that were part of that kickboxing scene. That you know, you find them in local gyms in the United States, excuse me, and then just bring them over. So there's plenty of those too, where it's just like, where is he finding these guys? But they all had, you know, karate, you know, credentials, kickboxing, boxing, whatever. And yeah, Inoki would always be the one with the hand raised.
Athena would have been a perfect opponent for Inoki had he lived.
Yes.
Right, Pat?
Who did you say? I'm sorry.
Bonavena. Had he lived?
Bonavena,
oh
yeah.
Man.
I said he would have been.
Honestly,
that's right up his alley.
That's probably a direction that he would have been better going down rather than the one he did. Obviously, yeah. I mean, you know, trying to do some wrestling or something like that rather than trying to
him going there and just talking a bunch of shit, just making fun of the audience. No one.
Oh,
knows.
He would have been a great heel. Yeah, he would have been a great heel, dude. He is such a gangly idiot, but. You know, or well, not gangly, just, you know, blockheaded, I guess. But the
he could have been like Primo Canera and just made a career out of it. Towards
and chances are he probably would have tried to double cross to know he was like a right hand, and then he would have got you were like, oh, yeah, I could take this bomb, and then like try to swing at him, and then you just get locked up in an octopus hold.
I think so, he could have been good in that shit, dude. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I believe the last Inoki versus boxer fight that takes place is fast forward to 1986. Inoki shares the ring with another former Ali opponent. The Rolodex keeps flipping. Yep. And here he is, Leon Spinks, who, to be fair, is not completely past it. He has just fought, I believe, Kawi for the very unsuccessful challenge for the Cruiserweight title. But he's still... I mean,
thank God the internet was not around back then, because that's really embarrassing.
I was going to say, so this, there is footage, not the full fight, but I was able to find cut footage of this fight. And guys, this is, I highly recommend, put this in the YouTube machine, Ali and Leon Spinks. It is Inoki and Leon Spinks. It is a very strange, like, 2-minute clip. The fight's completely awful to watch, but I will say, it looks kind of cool because it's so sloppy, and because MMA fights look sloppy sometimes. And this fight looks like two dudes just kind of grappling on the ground trying to figure it out, you know? So this looks cleaner than any of other Inoki's worked shoots, in my opinion. Leon seems like
copy, right?
What's that?
It's from the AP copy, right?
And Leon, I think you'd agree, Aris and Pat, pretty easygoing guy from his reputation. I could imagine was like, sure, whatever you want. Is the check clear? It's like, we can just do whatever you fucking want to do in the ring. And I think you kind of see a guy that's playing along and makes Inoki. I wouldn't say he makes Inoki look good, but it's like it doesn't look like things go south and like at all. Like, it looks like Inoki gets him on the ground.
He's not making it fucking homework for him, basically.
No. He gets himself on the ground after they fuck around on the feet for a while, and Inoki taps him out.
Wait, basically, like, a lot of those guys, a lot of whether they come from boxing, MMA, whatever it may be, they come with egos, you know, like we mentioned with guys we mentioned earlier on the show, and others I'm sure we'll bring up in a bit, but they come with a certain amount of egos and also a little bit of like aloofness, like, oh, pro wrestling is fake, I can take these little chumps out no matter what. Leon, like you just said, Gray, he was such an easygoing guy that he was probably the easiest person to work with, and that's why he was probably almost maybe at, in terms of like washed up boxers being sent to Japan, was probably the most successful and didn't really get embarrassed because he was such an easygoing guy. He just went along with anything. He wasn't going to bother anybody. You know, you want to do this and that to me? Yeah, fuck it. I don't care. Oh, we're going to have a death match, cage match? Well, sure, whatever. Like, you didn't, you know.
It just worked
out perfectly for him. And, like, you know, Leon worked for that. And so, yeah, that match, it is kind of, like you said, it is awkward to watch. It is, you know, sloppy. It is nothing really, but... like you said, and in terms of what they're trying to accomplish, it makes sense because it's not supposed to be like choreographed or look like it's working. It looks like it's supposed to be two guys that are trying to like actually fight, and it's a clash of styles, so it's supposed to be awkward. And it serves its purpose in that regard. You know what I mean?
It looks real.
Yeah.
So, I mean, real as he could be. As you said, Spinks kind of parlayed that into a career later on, going back to Japan for a company called Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling, which was head by this guy named Onita. Inishi Onita is just this wild man, like a guy that would come down to the ring smoking a cigarette, just a cool motherfucker. And so he started his own company, or I'm sure he had financial backers, but the company got pretty big for a while. It would go on tours and draw houses, and Leon Spinks sort of became part of this traveling troupe. So, you know, out there are, you know, clips of Leon Spinks wrestling Onita in a cage. There's clips of Leon Spinks wrestling Terry Funk. Like, Leon's got the boxing gloves on, but, you know, he's playing along and doing his
shtick. It was great.
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, Leon's really, at this point is, I think, you know, not...
he's in his element.
Yeah, he's in his element. He's probably, I think he's almost at the end of his boxing career. I don't know if he's flopped over and around for Giancarlo in Vermont yet or whatever, that DC or wherever that fight took place. But we're getting close to that point for sure. Leon's having a ball and making lots of money, taking the pin for guys in Japan. It's pretty...
there was a clip of him beating up some jobber at FMW. I don't know if it's on YouTube or not, but like, he... clearly, and like, his punches are so bad because he's so washed, and the people bounce around like basketballs, then they blade themselves too, which is hilarious. They're gushing blood all over.
Yeah, there's photos of Terry Funk just fucking covered in blood, and Leon's like, ah, you know, in some weird pose or some shit.
Terry's doing the drunk man dazed punches shtick that he always does. Leon's throwing these just fake looking haymakers. But
there's a clip of Spinks beating up this jobber dude, right? And then after the match is over, Leon, to see how much he plays into it, the guy is still laying there half dazed, and Leon pretends to help him up. And as he helps him up, the guy looks up to him, and Leon catches him with a sucker hook, and the guy falls flying across the ring. And then the crowd starts booing, and Leon goes,
"That's awesome."
It goes wobbling out, like shaking and everything. I'm like, "What the fuck?" I'm like, you can just tell he loves this shit.
The legend was that Leon was supposed to wrestle Taz in ECW, in the late '90s, back when Taz was this generously, I'm going to call him 5'8". But also was being presented as this complete badass. And I think you watched a little early UFC, but do you remember Paul Verlaine's at all?
Oh yeah.
Paul Verlaine's wrestles Taz and gets it's obviously a worked fight, but Taz chokes out Paul Verlaine's in the 2300 arena. So they, they were really obsessed with putting Taz in with like these, legitimate, shooter guys. So they were trying to get Leon Spinks to wrestle Taz, but Leon apparently was super drunk backstage and just like throwing up on himself. And they were like, "All right, fuck this, I'm not."
That sounds legitimate, honestly.
Yeah, so that's the legends told that we missed out on Leon Spinks in ECW.
Well, listen to this, guys. I was watching, UFC 96 the other day, because why not? And I think it was the first one that like Tank Abbott had showed up in.
So, oh yeah.
Yeah, and so they're panning the audience, and they showed Leon there. Leon was front row, and they're like, "We hear Leon Spinks is thinking about Juwan to join this one. It might be joining the next UFC. What do you think about that, Jim Brown?" Because Jim Brown, the football player, was a commentator back then. This
that would have been pretty early.
Yeah, and you hear Jim Brown, who probably knew of Leon's exploits, obviously from way in the day. He just here, he laughs and says, tongue in cheek, he's like, "Oh yeah, I don't know about that. I don't know how that worked out."
Yeah, because didn't they have Jimerson fucking fight Gracie?
Yes, he was the very first one.
And was
imagine what would happen to poor Leon, because Leon
and Art Jimerson tapped out to a guard. Like he didn't even he wasn't even choked or anything. Gracie just mounted him, and he was like, "I don't know what to do. Like I got one boxing glove on." Like you think that Art Jimerson was gonna do that well? Like fucking Shawash.
1995, 96, Leon Spinks in the UFC. Just think about that for a moment.
That's when he's And guys, if you want to see, I mean, it's sad. I don't want to wreck him, but like the fight with Giancarlo where he like just topples over immediately is on YouTube, I think. And it's like, so that's what that's the quality of Leon Spinks you would have gotten at that point. Like, Jesus.
Well, dude, it's actually pretty it's pretty wild too, because I mean a lot of it stems back. I mean, it's not to say that Inoki started this tradition, because wrestling has a long-standing tradition of crossing over with boxing going back into the 1800s. But I mean, even so, the American public had some varying degree of their view of pro wrestling and what they thought it was versus boxing for many decades. And so, generally speaking, you were going to be thinking of the heavyweight champion as like the toughest guy or whatever. And you weren't really going to be giving much regard to like the heavyweight pro wrestling champion or something like that, as somebody who could legitimately defeat this person or something like that, But here, starting with Inoki and, fighting Muhammad Ali and Chuck Wepner and Mildenberger and whatnot, and making a name off of doing this kind of stuff. A couple years later, Joe Frazier's in as a referee against Carlos Colon, I guess in Puerto Rico, apparently, and then winds up participating. Muhammad Ali, referee at WrestleMania 1, punches Roddy Piper. Scott LeDoux at Wrestle Rock 86.
Scott LeDoux is heavily involved with AWA. Like,
I mean,
it's past Russell Rock too. You would be shocked at how much Scott LeDoux is over the AWA product, like in the 80s. You'd be shocked.
And going forward, it's like a shitload of basically just popular fighters make their way over into pro wrestling.
There's clips of Ernie Shavers in the NWA, and they haven't, like, you know, in the Mid-Atlantic areas, but I've never seen them, but they're out there.
Holy shit.
They were at one point, I was watching something, a Clash of the Champions from like 1991 or whatever, and they show a clip of Ernie Shavers confronting Ric Flair. And he was going to be a special guest referee, and Flair is sitting there, and then you see Shavers show up, and he's like, Mr. Flair, you know, in his voice, I'm going to be very certain, blah, 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 and starts pointing at him. And Flair looks at it, puts his hands up, and is like, whatever you want. It's all good, you know?
Well.
Yeah, the wrestler is the or boxer is the referee trope. Yeah. You said that. I mean, you got Buster Douglas after beating Tyson as a referee, I believe, on Saturday Night's Main Event. And he punches Randy Savage in the face. And, of course, most famously, Mike Tyson punching Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania and then drinking a beer with Stone Cold. So, absolutely, it's just you can throughout history, man, it's...
And it's crazy too how those two things are going, because if you want to like add to that, so like the first one, when Buster Douglas becomes the referee for the Saturday Night Main Event, that slot was originally for Mike Tyson.
Yep.
You know, when Tyson got knocked out by Buster, that knocked him essentially out of that. Like, they were trying to build, obviously it was never going to happen, but there was always like that comparison, because Hulk Hogan and Mike Tyson and, you know, everything like that. And they're like, oh, you know, maybe we can build to a WrestleMania. Like, that was a pipe dream of everybody.
Of course. Two pop culture icons at their peak. Wrestling is red fucking hot at this point.
And if you listen to Hulk Hogan.
And Mike Tyson was huge in Japan.
Huge.
If you listen to Hulk Hogan and his ridiculous lies, he claims that they almost had a shoot fight and that was going to happen. But that's a whole
other. Tyson.
And by the way, you should check that out, because even though the punch looks ridiculous, the commentary beforehand with Vince and Jesse Ventura building up is absolutely perfect. Like, Ventura being the heel, and he was like, you know, Buster Douglas better be careful or the Macho Man will paintbrush him. And you hear like Vince, who clearly has no idea anything about boxing. He was like, Douglas hasn't done anything. Look at Randy Savage, peekaboo. I think he wants to go for a Jesse. He's doing peekaboo. And he's like, no, he's not. He's doing rope a dope. Yeah. You know, Buster Ali. So, like,
literally, what? Like, probably Young Aris and Young Gray and Young Pat would have been the only people believing, you know, Randy Savage could do anything to Buster Douglas, but it was still really funny to watch.
What's really interesting too is that fast forward years later, like you just said, Gray, when Mike Tyson becomes the special guest referee for the WrestleMania match between Stone Cold and Shawn Michaels, this is during the Attitude Era. Mike Tyson obviously had this is Crash TV, Jerry Springer, everything. Mike Tyson just got rid of, you know, bit Evander Holyfield, so they perfect for this whole thing. Some people may not realize this. The reason why Mike Tyson originally left Don King after this was because of Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon was trying to sign Mike Tyson exclusively for himself. Yep. That, as he was still trying to get involved whatever he could. He wouldn't get involved with boxing if he knew he can get Mike, because Mike was still the hottest commodity.
Vince's parent company had promoted Sugar Ray Leonard versus Hector Camacho.
Yeah. So I think the story goes, and there was in a book I read about Chris Benoit of all people, but they mentioned that Vince did something where they went through it, like he got a hold of Mike's books, like his financial books and all that, and he went through them and he saw how much money Don King was stealing from Mike. And I don't think Mike knew that, but Vince found out. He realized that, and then he showed it to Vince, and he showed it to Mike. He was like, oh, by the way, this is what Don's doing to you, bro. I just wanted to, you know, let you keep you abreast of everything. And Mike is kind of like, what, are you fucking kidding me? And
Vince is like, like in the Newfield book or whatever, or the
it was in it. So there's a book that came out.
I remember reading that.
Yes, there was a book that came out back in 2007 about Chris Benoit and just pro wrestling in general. It's never been renewed because the writer said it's so dark that I don't even think he wants to put it out again. But if you can find it online, I highly recommend it. But he brings up this whole story about the whole Mike Tyson thing. He talks about that, and when he brings up what he said, that he was like, Vince showed him a book, and that's when allegedly Mike went to go find Don King and kicked his ass. You know,
can you imagine what a Mike Tyson promoted, Vince McMahon promoted, like, career would have looked like?
Oh,
Jesus.
Well, that's what Vince was going for. That's what he was totally going for that. Yeah, that's why he exploited it. Yeah.
I don't want to imagine what kind of like racist tropes and costumes he would have been doing, dude.
Like Ron King was able to out Carney and outwit most of the other boxing promoters because they wouldn't be able to keep up with him. A guy like Vince McMahon, who comes from pro wrestling, was able to keep up with Don King. So that's why he was able to like, you know, exploit him.
So to shift a little bit, if that's okay with you guys, is like during that time period where wrestling is very entertaining. This is again 90s. We're getting to the Attitude Era in WWE, so it's starting to become more like, you know, it's not real. Like we're gonna do cartoonish skits and crazy shit like that. In Japan, meanwhile, especially in the early 90s, you're still getting you're getting this weird shift where wrestlers, there are a lot of wrestlers that are like, we kind of want to like, we're learning how to do all this cool shit on the mat, and like it would be nice to like do it for real. So you get like these weird splinter organizations that get founded that are essentially like the early fathers of MMA. So you get companies like PWFG and UWFI. I'm not gonna tell you what they stand for off the top of my head because I'm not that much of a, you know, Japanese wrestling expert. I'm not gonna pretend to be, but I know that those organizations, a lot of the guys that like splintered off and started those companies and would start doing work shoot MMA fights, those guys would end up going into Pride, or MMA, you know, was one of the first real MMA organizations. Now, granted, some of those fights were likely fixed in the early Pride events, but it turned into quite a real, you know, a real sport. So, of course, when you get guys that are trying to present themselves as legitimate athletes, you get some interesting opponents that get flown over from the United States. And in one example that I wanted to bring up to you guys, so I'll go in chronological order by year, but 1991, a guy named Nobuhiko Takada. Ooh,
this is a good one.
Who was one of the so he was one of the founders, really the founding fathers of Pride, and at this point, very similar to Inoki, a guy that really presented himself as a legitimate fighter, a legitimate tough guy. Probably was still at this point, but by the time he got to Pride, he was so banged up from wrestling and taking bumps and all that. And he was very washed up and frankly never looked good in any of his Pride matches. And I think he had a fixed fight with Mark Coleman where he beat Mark Coleman to like kind of make people believe in him again briefly, but very strange career. But at this point, he's in 1991, he's one of the centerpieces of this company. You know, really want to present him as a legitimate fighter. So he does a worked shoot with former world heavyweight champion Trevor Burbick. This is kind of like you said, we're going to go back to the Weppner Andre the Giant situation here, where these two guys clearly had an agreement backstage. And this fight really, really falls apart. And in fact, you can watch this fight.
It is hilarious. It's
hysterical to watch. So basically, they're in the ring, you know, up on the feet. Takada just starts throwing low kicks at Burbick. And Burbick's just like, what the fuck is this?
He looks so insulted, dude.
What's happening right now? He thinks these kicks are supposed to be above the weight. Like, I'm not sure what he thinks is supposed to be happening, but every time, you know, Takada throws a kick, he is increasingly pissed off, increasingly offended, trying to get closer, dude, to throw some punches. He's got, of course, the boxing gloves on, but Takada's like, fuck you, you're not getting in my range, and he's kicking him in the legs, you know, to the point where Burbick gets so incensed that he jumps over the top rope of the ring and just goes to the outside and runs into the crowd like, nope, we're not doing this shit anymore, and you know, Takada gets his hand raised.
This is during the era of Burbick when he, like, went completely off the deep end. Like, Larry Holmes drop kicking him off a car, he had other people trying to do things, he was getting in trouble.
And we did an entire episode about that shit, so I'll try to put that link somewhere during this.
At the turn of the 90s, Trevor Burbick, they said, you know, that clearly he was like something in his head like went off. And if you know Burbick, like you just said, Gray, the way he was acting and like responding, if you know how over the top he usually was in boxing, if you saw like his responses there, like, you know, sometimes the way he'd be yelling and just all the time and flailing and doing things, think of that except 10 times more in this match, because he is so flabbergasted that fucking Takada has the terminity to like kick him anywhere. And I guess beforehand there was, you know, he thought there was gonna be no kicks, it was just gonna be a fight. He's just freaking out. Like, he didn't throw a punch. I think he even comes out there, the first kick he hits him, he stops. So he's like,
I wanted to be a fly on the wall for what they were saying backstage was supposed to happen here.
Oh my god, I can imagine, because Burbick was such a psychopath, so like, yeah. Who knows what he was flailing about.
Again, the guys, I'm sure the guys that are told to book these boxers, it's like they see them on TV and they go, get me one of these guys and fly them over, and they'll do, you know, whoever will do the agreement, you know, and they have no idea like what their reputations are. They're just like, here's a, you know, a nice package of money and you're gonna fucking lose. And Burbick was probably like, okay, that's fine. And then, but didn't understand like how this was supposed to happen. And clearly there's, yeah, complete miscommunication. Well, I'll give you, I'm sure you'll put a link, Pat, to the description of the show, but it's, I highly recommend it. It's only 5 minutes long. It's great.
it's rough, dude. Burbick was definitely going off the deep end during this point, but yeah, it's clearly a demonstration that, you know, obviously that a lot of fighters could not hang in wrestling and mixed martial arts and stuff like that, especially with gloves on, the way that they were trying to do it and stuff like that, and the way that the narrative they were trying to push for decades and decades of boxing being the superior art form or whatever, that clearly, yeah, that it was tough. That was kind of coming off the rails and shit. But also, like you said, they were bringing these fighters over to Japan to kind of try to legitimize,
yes,
these shooters and these kind of hard style wrestlers that were, you know, yeah, that were trying to break in MMA.
Exactly. They like kickboxers, karate guys, again, just anybody that they could find that was like, oh, you do combat sports? Like, you want to come over and like lose to one of our dudes? Like, that'd be awesome. So another one that takes place in UWFI, this is sadder. This section is not really that funny. It's just like, what happened here? Kiyoshi Tamura, another legitimate fighter dude. They bring over Matthew Saad Muhammad. My first question to you, because you guys probably know the timeline a little better than me, is this a before or after like Muhammad's family puts the letter in ring, like, please don't let this man fight anymore? It had to have been around that time period, right?
Gosh. So this fight happens when you said around
92. Yeah.
Yeah. Saad Muhammad had no business being in the ring anywhere near a boxing ring by 1992. Like, he probably should have retired after getting knocked out in the rematch by Cowie. And that fight happened, what, 1983 or so?
Yeah,
82, 83. So it's been about a decade. He was going through financial issues. He was featured in the ring a few times talking about what was going on and like how he was back in Atlantic City, basically broke. He was married. His wife was begging him to retire. Everybody was just trying to beg him to retire, and he was getting his ass kicked by the likes of like Frankie Swindell and
Andrew Maynard. That's the one that really, yep, stands out to me. Yeah, me too. I feel like
got his ass kicked by everybody who was beating up Saad Muhammad. So yeah, like, it was a sad sight, but like you said, Gray, this one is like really, really depressing, because it's like another Trevor Burbick, where he gets brought over there. They probably
didn't know, like,
yeah,
this guy's completely neurologically fucked. Like,
and so they just gave him just like, you know, bullet points of what was gonna happen without actually breaking it down what really was going to go down. Oh yeah, don't worry, blah blah blah, you'll just do X, Y, and Z, nothing like that, and not realizing that it was going to be like some fucking stupid shit. Either that, yeah, or Sadma, I could see this too, because I think with the pre-fights they had interviews and all that, and as washed as he was, I could see Saad Muhammad being naive enough to think he was going to go there and just knock over some knock-around kid who didn't know what he was doing.
And so probably, yeah, yeah,
you know.
So if you watch, it's the fight clip again. It's on YouTube, so for sure we'll have a link. Muhammad gets taken down in about 30 seconds. Rear naked choke, ended. You know, good night. But again, I it seemed to me like a situation where they were like, we don't know if this guy can do anything, so we're just gonna just like literally end this as fast as possible. And yeah,
it's just the easy name to have.
It just made no sense. Off
chance that he throws some wild punch and knocks you out or something like that. Like, let's just fucking,
yeah, let's just get this guy on the ground. We'll just forget this even happened. So yeah, it lasts 40 seconds. It's something else. The final one I have on this list was a holy shit discovery for me, because I was not aware of this fight. This takes place in a similar federation to UWFI, PWFG. We get Maka Katsu Funaki, this guy is a legitimate MMA dude, like 40 wins in MMA, fought a lot in Pancrase. So he's one of the founding fathers of MMA for sure. This guy can fight. He takes on Roberto Duran in a t-shirt. Let that sink in for a second here. Roberto Duran shows up in 1992 wearing a t-shirt, and he goes in the ring for 10 minutes.
And think about this, very... 92 Duran, so it's not like he's like, you know, in shape or anything.
He this is like the Tasmanian Devil and Bugs Bunny wearing gangster attire on a t-shirt era Duran.
And you look at the comments of this video, I was like scrolling down and people were like, man, it's really sad to see Duran like this. Like, I'm like, this guy hasn't fought Vinny Paz yet. He hasn't challenged Joppy for the title yet. Like, this, he has years to go in his boxing career. Like, he wasn't
done. Had at least 9-10 years, man. He hadn't gone through Jorge Baca, Camacho. Like,
no,
I think that's a couple years before he went over and was like sparring with Nigel Benn and like embarrassing Nigel Benn.
I'm like,
and on that clip, I will say, like, it is one of the more odd things you'll see. He doesn't get embarrassed as badly as Saad Muhammad and Trevor Burbick do.
He does look like a dad fresh off the couch. Let's be honest. Like his hat said, he's got the Looney Tunes t-shirt on. He is not in good shape. Like, he's got the gut and he's in track pants. So I'm sure, like, if you're not familiar with Duran's career at that point, you're probably like, this is something to see. Like, Duran's definitely like probably 180, 190 this night. Yeah. Like, he is not in good shape. And according to a lot of, I've heard conflicting reports, honestly, if this fight was actually real or not. According to MMA fighter Josh Barnett, he's like, this was real. And like, Funaki basically was kind of carried Duran out of respect. And you could kind of see that a little bit. In this fight, but Duran does legitimately hit him with a body shot in round two of this fight, and it looks like it fucking stings. Like, he does travel. And so I was like, oh, that connect, like, it wasn't like a Leon Spinks like bullshit punch. Like, no, Duran hit him with a body shot and dropped him. So they kind of fuck around for a bit, and then kind of the same situation with a lot of these fights. Guy gets Duran, you know, Funaki gets Duran on the ground, and then I guess taps him out, but Duran never taps. Like, it's really strange ending, but it's definitely a situation where you're like, I don't know. It feels like they're almost sparring. And then Funaki decides, like, I don't want to take any more risks. Like, I have to beat this guy. Like, yeah. You know, so it's a strange, one of those strange shades of gray, no pun on my name, but a very strange fight for sure. But also get that full link and watch it for yourself. And it's a weird sight to see, but yeah, Duran has plenty more years in boxing after this.
Another one I wanted to bring up with you guys. So we talked about Inoki and how he had a thing where he liked to challenge, you know, different people from, you know, different combat sports backgrounds, whatever it may be. He also had a thing where a weird fascination outside of wrestling, where he liked to hobnob around with, you know, dictators. So to speak, right? Like, you know, very, very, very interesting people. Like, he had there's that famous, infamous, I guess, you know, promotion that he had in North Korea, where they forced a bunch of, you know, during the whole during the famine of North Korea, when just, you know, hundreds and thousands, probably millions of poor people over there were being like starved and forced fed or whatever. And so they're being forced into an arena to watch an event that they've never seen anything about in their life.
Collision of Korea, baby.
Yeah, to watch a bunch of, you know, foreign U.S. wrestlers who they've been, like, programmed to hate because they hate the U.S. in general, wrestle Japanese guys, and they have no idea what the fuck they're watching because they've been, like, blocked from that. So that's one thing. But Inoki also had a planned match one time where I don't know if it was supposed to be real or if it was supposed to be a shoot or a work or whatever it was supposed to be, but Antonio Inoki at one point was supposed to have a match with Ugandan dictator Idi Amin. And the reason why I'm bringing this up, because guess who was going to promote this match? Or fiasco, whatever you want to call this. Still alive today, by the way, in his 90s. Who is it?
You know, we're going to put on this fight one way or another, guys.
Yes. Bob Arum. And Tom was going to promote Antonio Inoki versus Idi Amin.
The apostle of apartheid.
Psychopath dictator who was known to be a cannibal and God knows how many people he killed in his cut. Like, just evil, evil, evil person. And Aaron was like, yeah, cha-ching, let's do this.
Wow. Well, Aaron, I feel like I'd love to hear, like, again, the book needs to be written soon, obviously. But I need to know about all the people he met and you know, pitched, I had ideas pitched to him like this. Just ridiculous shit, man.
But he said yes to. Like, I don't even think Don King would say yes to this. First, Aaron was the first one to go to South Africa to, like, during the heart of apartheid in the late 70s. It was like, yeah, let me try to make a bunch of money in Sun City with Sol Kerster. And that was before King got involved afterwards, too. But, like, still, that's a whole other thing that me and Pat have talked about on different shows. And then all these other, you know, the whole Evel Knievel fiasco that he promoted, I guess the Snake River thing, and a bunch of other shit. But it's like, the fact that he was going to promote this and probably willingly was going to do it is mind-blowing. Like, absolutely mind, like, where would you promote, like, it never came off, by the way, but where would you be able to, like, say, yes, this is going to be something, like, how are you going to, is it going to be
Luxembourg?
Anoki would probably be like, gotta be a double count out. I'm not jobbing to this fucking guy. I'm not losing. Like, you know what and I mean?
For some reason, like, I mean, obviously, his marbles clearly weren't all there. Do you think he was going to go along with nothing?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Is there even motherfuckers with, like, rifles outside the, like, fuck that.
It'd be like an Ali Raimi fight where, like, the guy gets, you know, gets brought into the ring. You ever see, I this is like one of my, like, I need to show you guys this clip, but it's one of Ali Raimi's last fights before he may or may not have died. But he's being led to the ring by two dudes, like, touting, like, just with fucking straight up, like, AKs, like carrying, like, escorting him into the ring. I'm like, that's what it probably would have been like. And I remember, you know, imagine you're an editor putting in, you're being told to put results in and for Ali Raimi fights, and they're like, here's the video, like, to prove it. And you're just, the first thing you see is Ali Raimi being marched to the ring by two dudes with fucking guns. It's like, okay, I guess I'll put this into box rack.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
the perks of being a box rec editor, for sure.
I wish I had saved that. That's one of my great regrets, is I didn't back that up. Yeah, because I've seen probably more Ali Raimi footage than probably anybody alive.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, and my great regret is I didn't back up. Unfortunately, would, you know, delete the videos, like, as soon as they go up on box rec, like, boom, see you later. So, but yeah, they'd have crazy entrances like that. So that's probably what that fight would have been like, Iris. Just a lot of guys with guns.
Yes, everywhere. And then Bob Arum just sitting in the front row. Like I was telling you guys earlier, I would love if this actually happened. And I'm assuming some sort of interaction like this might have happened. I don't know if Idi Amin was actually in the room for this, but like there had to have been some kind of meeting between Arum, Amin, and Antonio Inoki, where they were discussing all of this. And I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall just to hear the back and forth going on between these guys trying to come up with a plan of what they were going to do for this. Like, I would, my God, just hearing it. Well, listen, Edie, if wait, don't, I can't do an impression. Yeah,
the ego, but the egos and the insanity, like, I can't even imagine.
It's insane. But like, yeah, the whole, I mean, the one other thing I wanted to bring up before I guess we end pretty soon, but like the whole boxing and wrestling thing too, we've talked about a lot of boxers who get brought over and exploited and stuff like that. We should mention too that like some wrestlers who became boxers, or like their whole career kind of like went both ways. So the first one, the most successful one, and me and Pat, we've talked about him on a show a long time ago, was a guy by the name of Bearcat Wright. You know, Bearcat Wright, from the 50s, super, super popular in the black community, and rightfully so, because he was one of the first world champions back then. But his dad was the former contender Bearcat Wright, who fought Mickey Walker and a host of other guys back then. But very, very big guy, you know what I mean? Former boxer, just a general tough guy in general. But what happened with him, and this is a funny story, is that he got a little bit too big for his britches. Once he became champion, I think in the LA territory, which was Freddie Blassie's area and stuff like that, you know, the crowds went wild for him. Like people, you know, the community came out for him, the fans came out for him, everybody loved him and all that. And so he was getting just a little bit too hot-headed. But the thing is, no one, and since he didn't want to lose the belt, no one could really take it off of him because he was such a big fucker and he had hands. And I remember one time he was planning to lose it to Freddie Blassie, and double crossed Blassie in the ring. And Blassie, who's only pro boxing match was getting obliterated by Tony Galento, quickly got knocked out by Bearcat Wright. Like, he had no chance. So, the next time Bearcat Wright, the story goes, the next time Bearcat Wright was scheduled to defend his belt, and he didn't, there was supposed to be a certain opponent. The opponent he was supposed to wrestle against didn't come out. Instead, out came Judo Gene LaBelle.
Oh, shit. One of the legit motherfuckers
on the planet.
Yeah, run.
That's exactly what Bearcat Wright did. They say Bearcat Wright just jumped out of the ring and just
like 5'5" and has the grip of a fucking just an elephant. Just
do we mention that he was the referee for Ali Inoki, by the way?
No, we didn't, and that's a good point, dude. Yeah. Because between that's like we're like pulling characters all the fucking over here, man. And you know, Gene LaBelle's Eileen Eaton's son, you know, it's
Gene LaBelle is a fucking that's a father of MMA right there. I mean, even a lot of people that are in wrestling today and MMA owe a lot to Gene LaBelle. So glad you brought him up.
But that was the thing. They brought him out, Bearcat Wright, as tough as he was, saw that, and he was like, you know, and like in the movie Friday, you want a piece of meat? Nope.
He was like, bye bye, punk.
And he just left. He was like, I ain't fucking with this. But now Gray, you'll dig this one. Fast forward a bunch of decades later, a guy by the name of Tony Hallam. Big war guy, right? Who was a wrestler in WWE, Jesus. Also a pro boxer.
What a deep cut. Yeah, that Tony Hallam, or yeah, however you say it. Yeah, he had a little more than a cup of coffee with the WWF, but he was the environmentalist wrestler Ludwig Borga, who because a heel back then was somebody who from another country who pointed out how shitty America was with its fucking waste. He ends up boxing. He had a lot of fights in Denmark, and he had an MMA bout against Randy Couture as well, I believe.
But he beat Aaron Barkley.
He beat Tony Alvey. Yeah. I gotta ask Aaron Barkley, what the fuck, man? How did you lose to him?
Lost to Tony Hall. Yes. Aaron Barkley lost it. Even washed heavyweight Aaron Barkley still found a way to lose to that guy.
Yeah, so Tony Hall, there's a lot of mostly bad things about him that are out there on Wikipedia, so have fun reading about that. But yeah, he's probably one of the most successful wrestlers that went into boxing in recent times for sure. Think about Paul Roma was another one that also
had
a couple boxing matches.
Brian Adams crushed.
He was training to turn pro. I remember he never did.
Macho Man Randy Savage was going to be his manager or something, right?
Young Gray Johnson is on Fight News one day and absolutely pops when he sees fucking Brian Adams with boxing gloves and Randy Savage holding the punching bag. I believe he was supposed to turn pro on a Top Rank undercard. I believe it was the same one where I guess I don't remember the main event, but it was where Christy Martin had a comeback, broke her hand, and lost. It was on that show. That was
an HBO show because I worked there for Punchzone. That's one of the early Punchzone
shows. So Brian Adams was definitely supposed to pop up on a Top Rank undercard. Didn't happen, and he died shortly after, unfortunately. But yes, that was legitimately talked about as a thing, which would have been pretty wild. but we have one more, guys. This is breaking news today. I don't know if you saw this, Aris. But another wrestler that's going into boxing, it's going to be taking place on a Floyd Mayweather undercard. That's going to be good old Dubai. AEW wrestler. Well, I believe he just recently left AEW, but a man with a lot of controversy, Bobby Fish, who's I believe very old, way too old to be boxing. He is going to be turning pro against a fighter from Ghana who has a 2-3 record, according to BoxRec. So, yes, Bobby Fish, the pro wrestler, for those who are familiar. They literally just announced it a couple hours ago. It was on the good old Floyd Mayweather latest exhibition undercard. Mwah, that's all I'm going to say. Tommy Fury's got a fight on that card, too. So, guys, get excited. Get excited. It's going to be a real circus atmosphere.
Oh, my God, man. Oh, and the last question. Mark Maron never beat Riddick Bowe, right?
Fuck no. Mark Merrow never won a Golden Gloves title either. That's bullshit.
He used to pump that crap so much on wrestling. Mark Merrow beat Riddick Bowen.
Fuck that. And I don't think he ever won the Golden Gloves either. I looked that up because I was curious if Mark Merrow won the Golden Gloves. If he won the Golden Gloves, he won it I couldn't find it. Maybe he won a novice division 1980, whatever the fuck. But let me tell you, they were gassing that shit up, dude.
And when he fought in the Brawl for All, he clearly didn't have the skills that they were trying to.
No one's ever. Thank you, Aris. We're going to call that out right now. Mark Merrow, I think your accomplishments were bullshit. I don't believe it.
Straight up.
Boom.
As a speaker, but like, you know, yeah, man, I don't know.
That's what we're going to wrap up with, I think, right, guys? Fuck you, Mark Merrow.
Wow. From Inoki awesome. To Mark Merrow.
I think we covered the whole spectrum. This was a lot of fun.
That might even be what I named the motherfucking episode, from Inoki to Mark
Merrow. Oh, Mark Merrow doesn't see this.
I know. He seems like a really good guy. That's like
he's a like super nice guy. I got nothing against him.
He's going to see that. He's going to be like, really, guys? I'm going to be like, oh, damn. I'm sorry.
He's like a motivational speaker now, too. And like, seems like a good dude. So sorry, Mark
Merrow. He does, man. He's like changing little kids' lives and shit. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Sorry, buddy.
I'm still calling you out on your bullshit, but yeah.
Yep, I don't believe your boxing career.
Nah, dude, it's the worlds of wrestling, the worlds and the world of boxing, you know, that's there's so much overlap, dude. It's a big Venn diagram, and that sometimes it's a massive just fucking single circle. And so, you know, it's a lot of fun, though. I know that you guys are far more into it than I am. And I'm kind of like getting more into it, especially the history of wrestling and whatnot. Cause like I said, there is so much overlap. There are so many fighters who have either come from wrestling into boxing and gone from boxing into wrestling, et cetera. So, I mean, a lot of that though. And like I said earlier, it's not as if Antonio Inoki started all of that, but he really revived it. There's absolutely no question about that. And on top of that, he was, if he didn't have his hands into things that were happening in Japan combat sports wise, he was almost always ringside or being brought up, being recognized, acknowledged, and acknowledged for his influence too. So, I mean, that's really kind of the impetus for putting the show together and getting Gray here and discussing just some fun stuff, you know. Hopefully everybody enjoyed it. Gray, we appreciate you, man.
Hopefully you had your mind blown at a couple of the boxes we threw out there that had wrestling matches. I certainly, as I did research and reminded myself, I my jaw dropped a few times.
Burbick, Mildenberger, match. Duran, Saad Muhammad, dude, those are some pretty good pulls, honestly.
Yeah. So thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it, and hope you watching at home enjoyed it as well. So thanks for having me.
Always a blast having you, Gray. We'll sure have you back again.
For sure. Everybody who listened in, thank you so much. We really do appreciate you. If you listened in on any of those apps, please subscribe. Leave us a comment. If you watched on YouTube, also subscribe, comment. We'll try to reply to them. If we catch you on social media, though, that's probably where you're going to find us more often than not. The Knuckles and Gloves podcast is on Facebook, Instagram, but also on Twitter. Check out our buddy Gray Johnson on Twitter at BoxRecGray. And also Aris Pina, he's over there at Punch Zone Aris. Me, Patrick Connor, I'm there as Patrick M. Connor. Say hello. Talk to you guys later, man. Thanks so much.
Have a good one.
Later, buddy.